Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with Stephanie Dombra, The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And just every time we think we know something, we learn something else. More stuff fills us, tells us information about us, about what we know. Today we're going to talk about the psychopath, the mind of a psychopath. Why is that so important? The word psychopath conjures up movie images of inexplicable violence, like Jack Nicholson chasing his family with an axe in The Shining, or Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter. But real life offers other sets of images. Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy. Psychopaths are likable guys when they want to be, and it's part of what gets them where they are. What is a psychopath? Until 1980, the term was used for a personality disorder characterized by an abnormal lack of empathy, combined with strongly amoral conduct, but masked by an ability to appear outwardly normal. So let's get that. However, even with the changes in the diagnostic criteria, it is still the same thing we're doing here. We're talking about somebody who has a glitch, somebody who is unable to feel normal feelings and has certain parts that just don't work right. And their ability to harm people is enormous. Plus, they're usually very, very seductive. Do you know a psychopath? Here's a question. Their behaviors will tell you. They have great need for stimulation, and they tend to be bored. They're prone to boredom. They need activity. They have a kind of parasitic lifestyle. You usually see them hanging around, not necessarily earning the money to keep themselves going. They generally don't have jobs that would be where they would have to pay attention to a boss and follow rules. But they would be easily living on, you know, they'd be just hanging out at your couch or living in your house. That's called a parasitic life, parasitic lifestyle. They have poor behavioral control, a lot of sexual promiscuity, because they follow their impulses, a lack of realistic long-term goals. If you ask them what they want in the future, they'll usually say something very grandiose. But no realistic long-term goals. They're not saying things like, I want to save money for my 401k and invest it slowly in dividend appreciating. You know, they don't talk like that. They talk in grand things. They have impulsivity, irresponsibility, early behavior problems. These are the bad boys as kids. Juvenile delinquency. And usually parole or probation violations. Now, let's talk about that. So you see somebody out there, and you're a young woman, and you're 13 years old, and you feel confined by your own family and restricted by your family. And you see a guy who's hanging out, and he loves to create action. He loves to make things happen. He gets bored easily, so he's always carrying you along to some new place. He depends on you in some way, so maybe you buy the tickets, maybe you buy lunch. But you feel good about it because you feel like you're taking care of him. Sexual promiscuity, he's usually all over you, so he's showing you a lot of passion and attention. And he's not confined in any way. He's impulsive. He's irresponsible. He does all the things you would love to do, but you don't dare do. He has no shame. He has no guilt. And he gets in trouble with the police, and that makes him, yes, you know, he could have tattoos all over his body and piercings and no regrets for anything he does. How could that be attractive to a young girl? Well, to many young girls, that's the ideal. That's the bad boy. Many people will admit to being turned on to that, which keeps it going, in effect. Now, their emotional traits. A psychopath is very glib and has a superficial charm. There's a smile about them that is very seductive. They have a grandiose sense of self-worth. They feel very important. They're pathological liars. They will lie about anything, as long as it fits their needs. They're cunning and manipulative. They have a very significant lack of remorse or guilt. Now, that's kind of interesting, because very often you'll see when, I think they said, what was the statistic, Stephanie Dahmer in the studio with me today, number of people in the prisons who are psychopaths, 35%. Some big number, some huge number.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see that statistic, but it is high.
It is high, because what is it that keeps you in a prison, and why don't you get parole? Because when you go to a parole board, they're asking you to show remorse. And they want you to see if you feel remorse. And if you learn after a while that you could talk remorse, and so you give them the words, I'm really sorry for what I did, and I'm sorry I hurt those people, they let you out. However, the psychopath has the highest number of recidivism, the highest number of people who wind up back in the prison. Because the minute they walk out, there is nothing telling them don't commit a crime. Because there is no such concept. They have a right to do whatever they want to do in their own minds. So they're callous. They have a lack of empathy. They have a very shallow affect. It's not a very deep affect. It's shallow. It's limited. And they have a failure to accept responsibility for their own actions. They will blame others. Usually, they can be having many short-term marital relationships, a series of marriages over a period of time, series of relationships over a period of time. And there are many more things about a psychopath that you should learn about. But we've learned some new stuff. And the new stuff we learned is through imaging. By using imaging of the MRI and being able to study the brain, we've learned that there are many active and inactive parts of the brain. And here, my friends, comes the instructor, the teacher of the day. Mrs. Dambra, would you please...
Mrs.?
Would you please... Like in a classroom.
Oh, in a classroom.
Like in a... Mrs. Dambra, what is the insula? You know, and here it comes.
Okay.
What did we learn? What did we learn about the parts of the brain? New stuff. New different parts of the brain stuff.
Well, basically, what they've been able to prove is that through the imaging, they can see that there's actually an altered brain in psychopaths. And in there, part of the brain, which I'm going to describe, is it's almost like the muscle is weak. The tissues of this part of the brain are thin in people who have this kind of disorder. And it's in this area of the brain called the paralimbic system. And this is a group of interconnected brain structures that are involved in that emotional processing and goal-seeking and motivation and self-control. So it's all part of that old thing that we always talk about, the limbic system and the parts of the brain that are very old in us that work in almost like instinctually.
You mean when you say old, you mean like we have 40 years old?
No. Thousands.
Okay.
Older than the neocortex or that prefrontal cortex area that we talk about that's involved with very kind of sophisticated thinking and learning.
So this is real primitive brain
this
stuff.
This is a primitive brain part. And inside
and
that...
And we all have this primitive
brain.
We
all have this, but what they're finding is that this is damaged to some extent in people who have psychopathy.
Psychopathy, which is the very knowing word for how to say a person is a psychopath.
Yeah.
Very hip.
Well, I actually always prefer that, Armand, because I don't like to just identify a person as a schizophrenic psychopath.
So you say schizophrenia?
Yeah, because it shows that there's an actual illness or a potential disorder,
too.
Right. It's not just that. There's many components to a person, and this particular person we're talking about has a kind of a disorder, obviously.
Yeah.
So in this paralimbic system, inside there are the terms. I'll also try to explain them all. But inside the paralimbic system, we have the orbitofrontal cortex.
Okay, let's get over this again. The para... What part of the...
Paralimbic system.
Paralimbic system is like a... It's like a piece of the brain. It's all connected. But if you would imagine the brain had three layers, red, white, and blue, the mid part would be all white. That would be about where the paralimbic system is. Kind of all connected to each other. But there are five organs at least that are very important that are in the paralimbic system. And these are the five. And they're big words, but they're good words to know about.
Okay, so the orbitofrontal cortex is involved in this sophisticated decision-making, and it involves our ability to take risk and receive reward and punishment. And when it's damaged, people develop problems with impulsivity. They lack that insight, and they often have these big, you know, explosions whenever they're insulted. So a lot of times you'll see a person who's just really angry and screaming at somebody because they got that insult or somebody criticized them. So they don't handle those kind of things very easily.
So the orbitofrontal cortex, which is in the front of the brain, right?
Well, it's...
I think it is.
Okay,
it's,
well...
It's over the nose.
That's the next class.
Yeah. And that part, it learns from rewards. You know, don't you learn from your mistakes? Good question. Certain people can't. And it's specifically related to the orbitofrontal cortex is the insula, which we'll get to, which is about feeling pain. But we'll get back to that. Let's talk about another part of the brain.
Well, you just said where we learn from our mistakes. They're actually able to pinpoint that that's in another area of this paralimbic system called the anterior cingulate. And the cingulate regulates those emotional states, and it helps people control their impulses and learn from their mistakes, which is very important because that's exactly probably what's going on with this recidivism rate in the jails. Individuals cannot learn. They cannot incorporate. So many people, this is not just about psychopathy, but so many people explain to me, and I understand this concept, people will say, why can't that person learn this lesson? Why do they do this over and over again? And maybe a lot of people's part of this brain isn't working properly. So this part of saying, I made a mistake, and I'm going to incorporate this lesson, and I'm not going to do it again, is missing, or it's just not working properly.
Sammy, but you know, when you think about your average friend who falls in love for the seventh time in 2 weeks... You know, I was at a bar and I met this man and I'm in love with him. Same thing. You know, do we say it's anterior cingulate?
We're not there yet, but I'm going to extrapolate and hypothesize that that might be one of the areas. If these structures that I'm talking about are kind of, they're going to apply to everybody.
So maybe you could be drinking something that inhibits the anterior cingulate.
That's right.
Your
or those love chemicals make us be irrational. Okay, so that's just a whole nother show. But yes, these structures are in all of us, and we can't obviously identify which ones are working properly in anybody unless we scan the brain. But now that they're studying these people with psychopathy, this is what they're seeing.
This is Armand DeMille with Stephanie Dumber. We're talking about the psychopath and what we've learned. Some new information. We're learning about parts of the brain that they've been able to highlight and photograph through functional MRIs. And now you're able to see activity in the brain. One of the things they find is that the brain is like a horseshoe band of tissue nestled in the deep recesses of the brain. And this is, it malfunctions. This is the paralimbic system, which she was talking about, includes several interconnected brain regions. One is the orbitofrontal cortex. The other is the anterior cingulate. What else we got connected here, Stephanie?
Well, here's the one you just mentioned, the insula.
Oh,
I-N-S-U-L-A, insula. And that plays a key role in recognizing violations of social norms. And so that's an important thing, because if you're going around thinking, I can break laws, I can do whatever I want, I'm entitled to stealing that object or you know, raping this individual and not feeling any consequence, that's actually, they can pinpoint this now in the brain when it's underactive, so to speak.
And oh, you know, that's that underactive insulin, I'm sorry to interrupt you,
yeah,
also gives you pain perception limited.
Right.
So in other words, you could beat, let's say you get a bad kid, and the kid does something really bad. Let's say the kid goes running out and beats up your neighbor. So the average parent, primitive parent, will take that child, sit him down, and hit him. They'll punish him. But there are children like this who will feel no pain. Insula, an interesting word, because as in insulated. You see, in a way, they're insulated from pain. And because they don't have pain, they don't learn. It's the punishment doesn't make any sense. The insula plays a key role here. It also gives a person an insensitivity to two other things. They don't feel disgust, which is very fascinating. So, you know, the average one of us would be walking through a field, and if we saw dead bodies, we would, you know, regurgitate, we kind of vomit, we say, ugh, it's disgusting. They have a very high tolerance for things that would make other people disgusted. And they also have, that goes with repellent smells and with images. Now, who do you think would be great to have this quality? Who do you want to have this quality where they don't get disgusted by deadness or bad smells? Soldiers. Yes, soldiers. That's the ideal soldier. The ideal soldier, and I'm not saying this is true of all soldiers, but a psychopath is a perfect soldier if he would just follow the rules. Unfortunately, they have trouble following rules too. But put them in a place where they could blow stuff up and see dead bodies and not be fazed by it, and they reinforce each other by saying, see that, it doesn't bother me. See that head rolling over there, it doesn't bother me. And that's where you get the damaged insula. And when you see it, it's scary, it's spooky, you know, it's frightening.
Well, I wonder if you're already with that particular kind of brain structure before you even go into those kind of settings, and you are immune to it. Because if you're doing those things, a quote-unquote normal brain would have a lot of responses to it. So I think soldiers who actually have the PTSD, Armand, or if they're really suffering from those images, it's probably because everything's working. Whereas a person who has fearlessness and that inability to feel another person's pain, they don't suffer probably from post-traumatic stress at all.
Right.
You know, so this is more information for people to understand that, not that you want anybody to have post-traumatic stress. We were talking about that the other day, you know, that you try to find ways to prevent it from even, you know, taking place. But it's an interesting kind of dynamic that's going on inside many people's brains, obviously. But I think one thing that in addition to this issue of not being fazed by pain or the threat of pain for a person who has psychopathy, they can inflict the pain as well. And I believe that, I'm going to hypothesize, and it's probably out there, we just didn't come across it, they probably don't have as many mirror neurons the way another normal, quote-unquote, brain
well,
might
talk
have.
About, now you have to say what a mirror neuron is
these neurons that allow us to literally experience and feel what the other person is feeling. And the mirror neuron means that they can mimic what another person has going on inside their brain.
What a fabulous concept that is, because therefore, if I can't identify with your pain by looking at it and having my mirror neuron say, oh, look at how much pain they're feeling, I could feel it. If I can't do that, then I can inflict all the pain in the world, because I don't feel it myself. Wow. It gets scary. This is Hannibal Lecter stuff.
Yes.
All right. What about the other parts of the...
The last part is the amygdala, which we
talking
about.
What about the posterior cingulate?
Oh, that one?
Hmm. Yeah. And the temporal pole?
Those are two other ones, and they're also involved with how you kind of consolidate your memories emotionally. And if you're not able to, again, retain and keep your memories and remember something that's painful, then of course that's going to keep you from ever really feeling remorse or regret. They probably have a kind of a limited capacity to have long-term memories even. So that's probably one part of the paralimbic system that's also not working. And then the temporal pole, it helps you integrate everything. So this whole system is interconnected, and somehow the temporal lobe almost orchestrates all these things that are going on inside the paralimbic system. And again, those parts were shown as damaged as well on the MRIs.
So, you know, and now we're beginning to understand, how does somebody get like this? Because one of the big questions have always been, are you made that way? You know, here again, nature or nurture? Is it, are psychopaths made or born? And the answer is probably both. If, as investigators believe, genes account for 50% of the variability among those who exhibit adult antisocial traits. Now, this means that there's a big number of people who are born that way. Then there's a number of people who have a tendency to be that way. Given the right nurturing, they don't become that way. Given the wrong nurturing, they do become that way. So you're either born that way, have a propensity to become that way, and I don't know if you could actually drive somebody to that point if they don't have some chemical basis for it. What do you think, Steph? I think you got to have a genetic tendency towards it somehow.
Well, yes, and we were describing this last week in our show on nature versus nurture. And there was a neuroscientist who actually was part of, I guess they did the gene, they did the identification of certain genes in his family. And many of them, including Lizzie Borden, were part of his family ancestry. And so many family members had this genetic variant for criminal violence. He didn't. He had all the markings of it, but it was something that just bypassed him, and he was able to live a quote-unquote normal life and become a neuroscientist. So it does depend on, I think, a lot of factors. But yes, you can see these traits, sometimes more extreme than others.
So there are. The total sum determines the extent. There's a hair test, which we'll talk about, but it's... Let's go through some of the characteristics. Aggressive narcissism, right? In this, you have to think of somebody aggressively narcissistic. They have a glibness, a superficial charm. They have a grandiose a sense of self-worth, pathological lying, cunning, manipulative, a lack of remorse or guilt, emotionally shallow. Like their range is very small. Callous, a lack of empathy, and a failure to accept responsibility for their own actions.
And then there's this whole other area where we were describing earlier. They need stimulation. So probably there's something going on around that whole system in the dopamine reward system in their brain as well. So that means they need to have very exciting things happen. And, of course, violence really
gambling,
stimulates.
Violence.
All those things stimulate that part of their brain, that parasitic
danger.
Lifestyle. Danger. All
danger,
of, yep.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Guns, knives, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fair. It's not fair to the average psychopath that we want to take away their guns and knives because they want to blow things up too. Well, luckily we have the military. All right, so what else is there among the socially deviant lifestyle?
Okay, they have poor behavioral control, promiscuous sexual behavior, impulsiveness, they're irresponsible, and when they're probably younger, you can't totally see it all, but it's in the juvenile delinquency that kind of starts it from there. And then, of course, there's the criminal behavior and problems with relationships. They don't really have any long-term goals. There's a lot of things that if you were to look at the whole picture, you could say, wow, now we see it in a person.
But you don't necessarily see it in children, because in children, they have conduct disorders. They have somebody could have an oppositional defiant disorder. They can sometimes develop into adult psychopathy. But it fails to capture the emotional, cognitive, and interpersonality traits. Children showing strong psychopathic precursors often appear immune to punishment. That's the big one for we know about the about that part of the brain, you know?
They don't feel pain.
They don't. They feel immune less, yes. to punishment. Nothing seems to modify their undesirable behavior. So if you hit your sister and you whack her over the head and then so you get punished for it, you whack her over the head again. It doesn't affect you. The punishment doesn't affect you. That's a danger sign. When somebody is not affected by the punishment. And consequently, parents usually give up on the kid's bad behaviors and the kid worsens. So it's really kind of sad. But it doesn't blow into the... another sign that you usually get in childhood is an extended period of bedwetting past the preschool years, not due to a medical problem. So that's one of the signs. Precocious sadism, often found in animal abuse. They want to hurt animals. Fire setting. Lacking obvious homicidal intent, but not to be confused with playing with matches. These are fire setters. They set destructive fires with disregard for property. Lying, often without discernible objects. The lies are so extensive that it's also impossible to know lies from truth. Theft and truancy, aggression to peers and relatives, which include physical and verbal abuse, getting others into trouble, and psychological torment against somebody, picking on somebody. So very often you hear about bullying. It's very possible you have somebody with a potential psychopathy who is doing the bullying, and it has to come to your attention. So the three things, bedwetting, cruelty to animals, and fire starting, I call the McDonald triad. These are the red flag indicators of real potential psychopathic behavior in childhood. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, here with Stephanie Domra. Sorry to confuse you so much. Such difficult stuff. We are talking about psychopathy. We're talking about the person without a conscience. And we're talking about some of what we've learned, the new stuff, about the new information about different parts of the brain that work or don't work for these people. So we're trying to get a better understanding of them in some way, a better understanding.
Well, I think that one of the things we are understanding as well is that they need treatment just as well. So if you can't excuse behavior and you can't allow these kind of people to just be loose, so to speak, causing destruction and havoc, but at the same time, they really need treatment, and obviously prisons, it doesn't happen. So that's the sad part of it. It is a disorder. You know, we could say that they don't have remorse. We used to say they just don't have a conscience. Now we understand why, based on the structures and the physiology and all those kind of anatomical things that caused this in them. They didn't cause, you know, they didn't create it. In other words, this gets into a really complicated thing, because if you say this is a disease, then you go to the courts, you could say, I have an illness and that's why I did that. No. This is a problem.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, my friends, we'll take your calls at 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille with Stephanie Domra. We'll be right back.
WBAI, New York.
Hey, Hey, this is Armando Miller with Stephanie Dombrow, back with you with The Positive Mind. In the following weeks, we'll be playing you a number of drum solos, just short little spurts. And we'll explain all that at some point in the future. 212-209-2900. Before we take your calls, I want to talk about the insula again. Small part of the brain and its profound effects. I-N-S-U-L-A. You may want to look it up. Some people with damage to the prune-sized slab of brain tissue called the insula gave up cigarettes instantly. So if you had a damaged insula, it was easy to give up smoking. Suppose scientists could figure out how to tweak the insula without damaging it. They might be able to create that famed and elusive free lunch, an effortless way to kick the cigarette habit. That dream, which may not be too far off, puts the insula in the spotlight. What is the insula, and how could it possibly exert such profound effects on human behaviors? Well, according to the neuroscientists who study it, it's a long-neglected brain region that's emerged as crucial to understanding what it feels like to be a human. You got a damaged insula. It's hard to feel human. It's hard to feel it. They say it's the wellspring of social emotions like lust and disgust. Like those are very important feelings, lust and disgust. If you have a damaged insula, you don't feel those as much. Pride and humiliation, guilt and atonement. With the damaged insula, these are not words that really ring home to you. It helped give rise to moral intuition, empathy, and the capacity to respond emotionally, even to music. Funny thing about psychopathy, music is not a big deal. The only kind of music that may be attractive is, guess what? Heavy metal. You know, not for its tenderness. So, the insula also reads body states like hunger and craving and helps push people into reaching for the next sandwich, cigarette, or line of cocaine. So, insula research offers new ways to think about treating things. If we could just tweak this stuff, we could deal with drug addiction, eating disorders. But we don't know enough about it yet. We're just learning about this, and luckily, the information is coming about as we speak. You know, 20 years ago, what we knew about the human brain was nothing. Nothing. Steph, you remember, what do you think? It's about 20 years since we have neuropsychiatry.
Well, I think they started to think about these things when people with schizophrenia were medicated. They could see something was happening.
But when did we get the functional MRI?
That's probably been
12 years.
10, 15 years max. And now, even just in the last 5 to 7 years, the ability to kind of slice genes thousands of times and pinpoint, it's fascinating. It's all just recent.
It's just about the same development as a cell phone, as both the cell phone and the computers. Kind of all goes together. You know, all of this is speeding along, and what we knew 15 years ago is amazing compared to where we are now. We're going to take your calls now. There's a tendency for everybody to say, is that person a psychopath? It's hard for us to tell, but we'll certainly listen to your calls, because without knowing it, you may have been the victim of a psychopath, or you may be one yourself. 212-209-2900 is our number here. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armando Miller with Stephanie Dombra. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. I'm a longtime listener, and I thoroughly enjoy your show. My name is Gordon.
Hello, Gordon.
And Armand, I'm listening to this, and I'm laughing to myself. It reminds me of my ex-father-in-law. And yesterday's newspaper, the New York Times, on Tuesday, had a very sad article of a college football player that suddenly, out of nowhere, committed suicide. And they said in the article, it's called chronic traumatic encephaly. Now, that's swelling of the brain. From brain damage, from numerous times, and they related it to the NFL players, 10 of them in the past 10 years, and their erratic behavior, definitely related. Now, the sad part about this trait, and like alcoholism, violence, incest, it goes from generation, I'm now dealing with teenage daughters who are off the wall sometimes. Honor students, great, but really enjoy a little psychological torment and taunting, and their grandfather, who passed away, who was this football player, really, he was restrained by court officers. I had to have him arrested, and I don't want to get into the details of all that, but just a narcissistic, and everything was about him. Pictures in the house all over of him, you know, one little picture of the family, and I'm listening to this, and I'm laughing, but my real dilemma, as a longtime listener to you, is I have a responsibility to my children to give them guidance to be a parent.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It has to be done in a loving way without educating. Don't try to teach your children.
By example, kindness and listening, as sure. I learned from my parents.
Right, without teaching. The big mistake that all parents make is when you realize something that your child doesn't know, you try to tell them about it, so you teach them. Let me explain to you about your grandfather who was a psychopath.
Never
teach. Right.
Never. And if I can say, one time they were having this outlandish behavior, and they had what I call crocodile tears because I was, you know, denying them certain privileges. And I said, knock off those crocodile tears. And they said to me, no, you told us it's okay to cry. And that was like from years ago. I had forgotten about that. But I just wanted to put that out there, a traumatic brain damage. And if you're in jail, most likely you've been beaten up, you're in gangs, you're punching people, and it's called CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, New York Times on Tuesday morning.
Well, take a look at it. Thank you very much for calling
Thank
in.
Thank you. Thank you for all your great teachings.
Thank you. You know, in 1801, Philippe Pinel describe patients who are mentally impaired, but nonetheless engaged in impulsive and self-defeating acts. He called them la folie raisonnante, which meant insane without delirium. Means they fully understood the irrationality of their behavior, but continued to do it anyway. You know, it's like you saying, you know, this falling in love thing, yeah. Oh, there you go again, falling in love all over again. And you say, yes, I know, and then you just do it over again. I mean, the big secret is, do you learn from your mistakes? A student of Aristotle's, Theophrastus, in ancient Greece, wrote a description of the unscrupulous man. And he said the following thing, the unscrupulous man, he didn't say it in English, by the way, he said it in Greek, will go and borrow more money from a creditor he has never paid. Right? So that's what the unscrupulous man will do. He will borrow money from you, will not pay you back, and get you to lend him more money. When marketing, he reminds the butcher of the same service he has rendered him, and standing near the scales, throws in some extra meat. If he succeeds, so much the better. If not, he'll snatch off a little piece of meat and go off laughing. He just feels like he has a right to do it. So that goes all the way back to Aristotle's times, the description of the psychopath, a person with no conscience. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Armand.
Yes.
Hi, this is Kwesi. I spoke with you about 2.5 years ago, and you had a program and you spoke about psychopaths or the psychopathy. And I told you that I worked with a couple, but the thing that gets me about today's program is the progress in the information.
Yeah,
progress,
it's amazing.
In the imaging. It's amazing. It's so hopeful. It's just a delight to hear this discussion, because this was not a discussion when we last spoke.
That's
this
right. 2.5 years ago, I had no idea.
No idea, and it's like it's at warp speed almost. It's wonderful. And thank you for your programming, as always. Thank you
for calling.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, you're as excited as we are about the information as it comes by us. It's a privilege to be able to do this radio program. It's a privilege for me to be able to present information to you. As difficult as it gets, it's wonderful. Wonderful to hear how we feed and take care of the rest of you, how much you appreciate this. And Stephanie, I really appreciate how much of this you do with me and how we dig this up and how exciting it gets as we discover new information.
Thank you, Armand.
212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. DeMille?
Yes.
Hi, and your guest. Hello. Thanks for a great program. I had two quick questions, and I'll take the answer off the air for efficiency. One is, I was surprised, not surprised, but, that one of your guests said that these people may need treatment and eventually maybe even prisons. And what struck me is that, as a former Wall Streeter, the qualities you're describing are actually qualities that serve people really well in big corporations.
Oh, certainly. In the movie Wall Street, we saw it in full force when Kirk Douglas was playing that personality.
Gordon Gekko, yeah.
Yeah, Gordon Gekko is absolutely perfect.
Yeah, do you have any reflections on how, in the long term, we might change so that, I mean, really, it's so severe that really the tops of a lot of institutions, not just Wall Street, but even universities, hospitals, doctors' organizations, the most ruthless person rises to the top.
No. Psychopaths usually don't ride to the top. Usually they get in their own way. At the top level, they get noticed because they're usually living, they're kind of living off people rather than producing as much. So the Gordon Gekko may be an exception to it, but I don't think the psychopath is the one who's the most successful. Psychopathic tendencies, not having guilt, not having shame, or some of these things that we're talking about, may be there. But the real damages are usually criminals, people who hurt people. See, that's where you usually see it, because it's very hard to stay within a system when you're psychopathic. It's like you're... A good example of psychopathic is Taxi Driver. You remember the movie?
Yeah.
Okay, in Taxi Driver, where Robert De Niro... No, it wasn't Robert De Niro, was it? It was Robert De Niro. Plays a taxi driver, right? And you see him in his own. That's psychopathy. That's the way it is. He's not going to go out there and go work for somebody.
I see.
That's that feeling.
And just the other question, maybe this is goes to the my misperception, but I just wanted to say I think George W. Bush exhibited a lot of those qualities. But the second question is, what is the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath?
Well, there's a big one. Steph, you want to take that on? We have it. We asked that question. We said, let's talk about the difference between psychopath and sociopath. And luckily, we have brilliant audience who say, in case you left this out. Go ahead.
Okay. So the issue is that psychopaths are born with these differences, and they have this whole impulsivity. And we didn't mention this one piece about the cortical underarousal, which means that they don't release cortisol the way most of us do.
Now talk about that. That's important.
Okay.
When you say release cortisol.
Okay.
You mean when they get excited, they don't release cortisol, which would make them energetic. What would it do to them?
They don't feel anxiety.
Right.
And so, and we will get to the sociopathic issue, but the cortisol is very key because that, when we feel anxious, cortisol is released. And what they've been able to determine with other kind of scans and blood tests with people who have psychopathy, there's no increase in cortisol. And so they can do lie detector tests beautifully. They go sailing through those. They don't feel any arousal. So when people say, cold as ice or in cold blood, it's because they don't have that. And so they are fearless. Their amygdala does not fire the same way that another person's. And so they don't worry about things. And this whole system doesn't work right for them. So this inability to internalize all these kind of things and the social norms is what really is a psychopath, we'll say. But the sociopath has relatively normal temperaments, and that their personality, disorder is more of an effect of negative sociological factors like parent neglect and delinquent peers and poverty. So the sociopath they consider is because of the society, their culture, the environment around them is influencing them. Psychopaths, it's internal. That's the difference.
Good job. How did that work for you? Do you understand that as the difference?
I think he went off the air. He said he wanted to hear our answers
good,
after.
Good
but
for you, Stephanie.
Thanks for your question.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi there. You're on the air.
900.
Hi there. Lower your radio, please.
Give me a second. 900. Yes, hello, hello.
Yes, hello, hello.
Yeah, Armand. This is Lenny Haywood. I listen to you sometime. I want to know what your opinion is. I don't know what your topic is today, but the opinion of these kids sagging. I don't know if you ever touched on that. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are.
Michael? 212. Hi there. 212-209-2900. I think we lost that call. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi there. You're on the air. Well, I think we lost the connection.
No, go ahead, call.
Hi there. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Is this Armin?
Yes.
Oh, hi. It's Paula. I have a question.
Hi, Paula. I have a question.
Yes. You're talking about, like, sociopath and the...
psychopath.
Psychopath. The sociopath, you said it's because of the environment?
That's the tendency. That's the way they're kind of viewing it. They see a sociopath as a product of the environment, while the psychopath is kind of born with it, and it manifests through a dysfunctional environment as well. And maybe not even have a dysfunctional environment. You could be perfectly fine, family loving,
right,
and have a kid who just starts off this way. I know many parents
as a sociopath
who have these children who are just defiant, brutal children, and they just don't know what to do. So we're just learning what we could do. But your question is?
Yeah, because my ex, I believe he was a sociopath. Well, he is a sociopath because he, I don't know, he behaved, he had some of those qualities that, about like the environment, and he grew up like in a good environment, but also, I guess later on he strayed off into adulthood, into other environments, and he just does like radical things.
Okay, now I want to talk to you about this for a minute because you, what's your name?
Paula.
Paula. Paula, at one time you found him to be a very exciting man.
Yes.
I mean, he was full of fire.
Right.
He was spitting on the streets. He was doing anything he felt like doing, and you looked at him and you said, ooh, he's a bad boy and I like him.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, now, here's my question. With that in mind, did you ever say to yourself, well, maybe he's a little too much of a bad boy? Or did you say to yourself, like most people do, I can enjoy this energy of his because he is doing what I would love to do, it's just that I don't have the nerve to do it?
That's the second one.
Yeah, the second one, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that women or people with passive-aggressive personality disorders, people who are not good at expressing their own anger, very often will hook up with somebody who is sociopathic or psychopathic to have them act out their anger. And when the time comes that you get comfortable being able to express your own anger when you feel it, you won't need this kind of person as your hired gun.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, that's happened to me. Yes.
It did happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want any more of these bad boys?
No.
I got it.
I'm done.
Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Armand.
Yes.
It's Mitchell Rabin. Hi.
Hello, Mitchell.
How are you? It's been a while, huh?
A long time.
Definitely, definitely. I just want to say I'm enjoying your show so much. It's really a great show, and I listen as often as I can. A statement that Stephanie had made earlier about knowing the causes of this kind of, you know, psychopathological behavior. I just wanted to, being, you know, essentially different kinds of neural dysfunctions, I just wanted to kind of weigh in and say, my thought is really that the neural dysfunctions are a function of poor mammalian prenatal care, and that it really goes back to the relationship of the embryo and fetus to the mother, and even to the father, their conversations, and a whole series of basically what you'd refer to as prenatal psychology.
Sure.
I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, could be. You know, I studied the work of new personally, Stan Grof, who studied the perinatal matrix, and it was part of his belief system that it was in utero that mm-hmm. most of personality is formed.
Indeed.
He says because the chemistry, obviously you're familiar with his work as well.
Yeah, sure.
That's only two of us. So yeah, I kind of go along with you. Just as good as anything else, and I would say probably there's genetic, there's probably in utero, plus there's sociological as well.
Exactly. There are. It's a confluence of influences, but I wouldn't want to really overlook the importance of really quality parenting, not from the moment that the infant is born, but way before that.
Way before that.
You know, where we could even refer to as some idea of conscious conception, and, you know, going forward thereafter, you know.
So at least that's a very interesting concept, conscious conception, because you really want to consider that as well.
Yes.
You know, Le Boyer, I'm sure you're going to know who that
sure.
is as well.
Sure.
Frederick Le Boyer was somebody who I contacted in Paris originally.
Uh-huh.
And he was the one who was doing Birth Without Violence, and he believed that children should be born underwater.
Yes.
Should be born with gentleness, because he believed that the in utero effect of the violence that they are feeling, and as a result of the parents' stress.
Yes.
He said made a major difference. And some of the follow-ups that they did with the children born underwater is amazing.
Yes.
The kids are significantly more peaceful.
Yes, indeed. And just the trauma.
I wish I were born underwater. That would have been nice.
To the skull itself, Armand, passing through the canal, is that there's an immense amount of pressure on the skull itself,
which, of course,
is affecting the entirety of the nervous system. And we just don't factor that into our usual psychological thinking.
Mitchell, thank you so much for calling in and
Absolutely.
Reminding
Absolutely. Really
us.
A pleasure to hear
nice
you.
Nice to hear
and
your voice
you
again, yes.
Yes, it will do.
Okay. Hey, Steph. See? Old-timers who know the old-timers as well. So this is Armand Amour with Stephanie Dombrow. We're going to be going very shortly.
I just wanted to add, because I know the caller said, are there things that can be done? And there is one program that I was reading about with juvenile offenders who have some of these psychopathic tendencies, and they've had tremendous success. And what they've done, this individual, Michael Caldwell, who was a psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison, Wisconsin, uses extensive one-on-one therapy so that it's known as decompression, and it's aimed at ending this vicious cycle where punishment for bad behavior inspires more bad behavior. So they must be working on a way to do a different system altogether and do away with punishment and figure out another model. So we'll have to research more of that and report on that. But at least there's something working.
Hey, this is Armand Amour with Stephanie Dombrow. Stephanie, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We will be back with you on Tuesday, my friends, at 1 p.m. If you want to pass this program along to somebody, just have them go to the website, thepositivemind.com. And do, if you're a Facebook fan, do look at The Positive Mind on Facebook. Join us. Be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m.